you take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. We love the earth. It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Wednesday, April 4th, 2018, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Thanks for joining us today. Of course, today you've heard in the news all day the ignominious anniversary of the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, April 4th, 1968. And as someone who was born in 1968, I gotta say, what a hell of a way to welcome me into this world. First year of my life, we have the assassination of Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, we have the Chicago convention, riots that they had. We had Nixon being elected president. We had the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Boy, that's not easy being 50, but Dr. King assassinated 50 years ago today, and that brings up the subject of today's radical rant, where I'm going to discuss racial reconciliation in America, which is impossible so long as we continue this war on certain American citizens using non-pharmaceutical, non-alcoholic, tobacco-free drugs. That's right, the war on drugs is racist. It's not controversial to say so. We're going to take a look back at just how racist it is, the history of our war on drugs and the people behind it, and a look at Martin Luther King himself, how he was more than just the lovable civil rights icon we all think of, but he was a radical revolutionary who was taking on not just civil rights, but capitalism itself. So we'll take a look at a few of his quotes that maybe you don't hear as often as I Have a Dream. Also coming up on today's show, we'll have part two of my look at the Monitoring the Future survey. We're digging in deep into the data. It goes all the way back to 1975 to take a look at what has happened to teenagers in America since we have legalized marijuana. You know, it's supposed to be the gateway drug. It's supposed to give the wrong message if we legalize pot. We'll see what the data say about that. That's coming up right after the cannabis headline news. That's up next. We're doing a lot quicker, more of a lightning round type of a news. We'll try that out for today's podcast. I hope you like it. And also on the program, we're going to go back into the vaults where we spoke with Major Neil Franklin from Law Enforcement Action Partnership on the subject of Baltimore cops getting caught planting drugs on suspects on their body cams.
This is your cannabis headline news, brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net, the complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your cannabis headline news for the week of Wednesday, April 4th, 2018. I'm Russ Belville. Legalizing marijuana for recreational use lowers opioid prescribing even more than medical marijuana laws do. That's the conclusion of a new study published by the American Medical Association. Authors concluded that state implementation of medical marijuana laws was associated with a 5.88% lower rate of opioid prescribing, while states with adult legalization of marijuana were associated with a 6.38% lower rate of opioid prescribing. Another study of medical cannabis states found that dispensaries reduce opioid prescribing more than home cultivation does. States with active dispensaries saw 3.742 million fewer daily doses filled. States with home cultivation only laws saw 1.792 million fewer filled daily doses. Marijuana Business Daily reports that the Internal Revenue Service has issued a policy update that bans new cannabis lobbying. The little heralded provision declares that the agency will not acknowledge tax-exempt applications for any organization, quote, whose purpose is directed to the improvement of business conditions relating to an activity involving controlled substances, which is prohibited by federal law, regardless of its legality in the state in which such activity is conducted, end quote. Democratic Governor Ralph Northam reiterated his campaign pledge to decriminalize marijuana in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
There are a lot of lives that are ruined by making mistakes and being put in jail. And there's a discrepancy between whether African-Americans get arrested versus Caucasians. So a lot of inequities there.
Northam said he'd try again in the next session. Northam recently signed a bill enabling Virginia doctors to recommend cannabis oil to treat any medically diagnosed condition, widening access from previous law, which limited such recommendations to those with certain forms of epilepsy. Former Sex and the City star Cynthia Nixon is campaigning strongly for marijuana legalization in her New York gubernatorial bid. At a private fundraiser, attendees report that Nixon was, quote, very exuberant about ending prohibition, saying she would, quote, legalize marijuana and put a tax on it, end quote. Nixon is running for governor as a Democrat, challenging the incumbent governor, Andrew Cuomo, who's a staunch opponent of legalizing marijuana, which he calls a gateway drug. A February Siena College poll showed that 56% of New Yorkers favor marijuana legalization, including two-thirds of Democrats. Oregon's bud tenders are doing a far better job at keeping their product out of the hands of underage purchasers than Oregon's bartenders. The latest minor decoy operations conducted by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission show that the last five marijuana stings, comprised of checks of 43 pot shops in 14 cities, failed to net a single instance where a licensed Oregon marijuana retailer sold product to a decoy. By comparison, the last five checks of alcohol retailers, comprised of 84 locations in 7 cities, found that 13 provided access to booze to people under 21 for a compliance rate of 84.5%. For 2018, the overall compliance rate for marijuana retailers has been 92%. Ohio Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur is the latest official to spread the fentanyl-laced marijuana myth. Kaptur told Cleveland's 19 News that
what is going on the street is that marijuana is being laced with heroin, and now we have this problem of fentanyl and carfentanyl, which are deadly.
Numerous media reports of marijuana laced with opioids have surfaced, only to be corrected days later when officials determined the field drug test was inaccurate or an overdose victim lied. Michigan's gubernatorial hopefuls would continue prohibition of marijuana for adults. During a town hall at Michigan State, current Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly stated flatly, quote, I oppose recreational marijuana, end quote. State Senator Patrick Kolbeck opposed legalization because, quote, a lot of companies still require drug tests, end quote. Dr. Jim Hines said legalization, quote, would be a disaster, end quote, but supports medical use of marijuana. Attorney General Bill Schuette, also running for governor, did not attend the town hall. In 2008, Schuette campaigned against medical marijuana in Michigan, and in 2015 said that legalization is an issue to, quote, let the people decide, end quote. Michigan activists are confident they have the signatures to put legalization on the ballot this November. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for the week of Wednesday, April 4th, 2018. I'm Russ Belville.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. The Marijuana Agenda free podcast is available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, SoundCloud, and on our Facebook page at MJ Agenda. Free video archives are available at the Radical Russ channel on YouTube. Help keep this media free by making a donation at paypal.me/radicalruss. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Hey, I am your stoner.
Learn more at mjagenda.com. This year in the United States, the opioid overdose crisis will take over 60,000 American lives. The use and abuse of alcohol will claim over 90,000 American lives. But the government still wants to crack down on Americans who smoke marijuana, which has never killed anybody. If this were a war and the enemy killed 150,000 Americans, would we go invade some country that had nothing to do with it? Wait, don't answer that. Skip that.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal Potland, Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House. Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159855.
Promoting the end of adult cannabis prohibition is easy because we have facts, science, reason, compassion, evidence, truth, and logic on our side. It's even easier when researchers catalog it all for us. Learn how to gather the facts on marijuana use, arrests, seizures, rehabs, drug tests, and more on this edition of Drug War Data Mining.
Today in the Data Mines, we go back to the Monitoring the Future survey. We talked about this on last week's program, and I had just gotten about halfway into my mining. What I've been doing is taking all of this data that is provided on a PDF file and meticulously copying and pasting it into Microsoft Excel so it could actually be usable by people, by researchers, by journalists, by anybody who cares about this. Any drug war data geeks out there, this file is for you. And it's now available through my Marijuana Agenda website. If you go to mjagenda.com, and you're a $9.99 a month patron, you can download two Excel files that I've now uploaded, one that contains all of the data tables and another one that contains all of the pivot charts. So you can look at the raw data itself, or you can chart it out in some beautiful full color charts that we'll take a look at. And again, this is for the $9.99 VIPs. And if that's too much per month, hey, just join for 1 month. Download your files, and then unjoin. I'm fine with that. I'm absolutely fine with that. But for those of you who are supporting the show at the $9.99 level, thank you so much for doing so. And let's take a look at what you've got available now in this Monitoring the Future survey, which I'm told by Dr. Keith Saunders is impossible. You can't monitor the future. But we'll talk about the data. And that data is quite interesting because we've been hearing about how marijuana legalization was going to lead to kids getting the wrong message. Oh my God, if we legalize weed, kids will think drugs are okay. They'll get the wrong message. They'll think drugs are okay. And we all know marijuana is the gateway drug. Marijuana is a gateway drug. It's going to lead them straight to heroin. They get addicted. They'll die of a fentanyl overdose, right? That's what we've been told. Well, as you can see from this data that I've just put in, last week we talked about this. I was showing you lifetime use rates and annual use rates, right? And we found that when it came to the lifetime use rates, kids weren't using any more weed than before. In fact, they were using less and using less drugs overall. Like, the chance that a kid has tried any drug is lower now than it has ever been. But that still left open the possibility that, well, yeah, maybe the kids are less curious to try drugs, but what about the kids who are using drugs already? What, the ones who didn't say no? Are they using it more often? Are they more likely to be involved in a habit? That is, the kids who experimented, maybe it didn't affect them, but the kids who were hooked, maybe it did affect them. But as you can see from this data on the screen, this is from the drug use tables. And one thing you can notice about the drug use tables is how I've color-coded all the drugs. All the drugs have a specific color to them, right? Blue, red. And I've kept them in families. Like, all the cocaine drugs are red, and all the pills are blue, and all of the hallucinogens are purple, and all of the plant-based drugs are green, right? So there's some method to my madness there. But what we've got on this chart is a look at the monthly use rates of any particular drug. Has a kid tried this drug? Has a kid used this drug in the past month, in the past 30 days? Now, that could be every day. That could be once at a party that month. But did the kid use drugs this month? And we go back all the way to 1975, and we're talking about 12th graders in this chart. 12th graders' use of drugs. And where you see the red represents the rates that were in the top five of most use. Now, you're not seeing all the years. I can't fit all the years on one screen. So it goes 75, 80, 85, 90, 95, 2000, 2005, 2010. And then once we hit 2010, I'm showing you all the years, right? So you're missing a lot of, you know, we've compacted the past four decades previous. But what you see, even with that, even compacted as it is, you see that the worst monthly use rates for 12th graders for all these drugs and alcohol and tobacco too are almost all sitting on the left side of that chart, of that table. The worst use rates for drugs all happened before we legalized weed. And look to the right side. all that green that you're seeing are the five lowest rates ever recorded. And the lowest one is the one that's shaded in green, right? And you can you see how many of these drugs recorded their lowest ever monthly use rate in 2016 or 2017? Fewer kids are using drugs monthly now, after 2012, after we legalized, fewer kids are using drugs regularly than ever recorded in history. So much for that gateway drug, right? So much for that wrong message. And on the far right column, you can see just how much that drug use rate has declined on a relative basis from its absolute peak. And overall, for all drugs, two-thirds less drug use than its absolute peak. Two-thirds less drug use. So when they talk about, when you hear the president coming out saying, oh, we've never had a drug problem like this before. We've never had a problem. Not when you take a look at the use rate among kids, it's lower than it's ever been recorded. Apparently, they're not getting the wrong message about drugs because of the legalization of marijuana. Now, if you download this chart, you're going to these tables, you're going to find all sorts of great information in the charting file. You'll get a table that looks kind of like this one over here, and you're able to pick which frequency. Would you want lifetime, monthly, annual, or daily use of drugs? You get to pick which drug: meth, coke, heroin, crack, Rohypnol, GHB, Ritalin. They're all in there. You get to pick which years you want to display and which grades you want to display. And when you come up with that list in the table, it then generates this chart for you. So I picked meth as an example. This is lifetime use of meth. Dark line is the 12th graders. Dashed line is the 10th graders. Dotted line is the 8th graders. And you can see with meth, it has decreased to its lowest use rates ever. So with this data chart file that you can get from MJAgenda.com, you can get this kind of graph for any drug. Since 1975, for any drug, is available now for the VIP patrons of MJAgenda.com. And there's another way you can chart the drugs. Maybe you want to compare one drug to another drug. Like, okay, what's happened to marijuana compared to, say, cigarette smoking or something like that? That allows you, in our file, you can build that table as well. And these are all pre-built for you. All you got to do is go up to those little drop-downs and choose what your frequency is: monthly, annual, lifetime, daily, which grade you want to look at. I've picked 12th grade here. Which drugs you want to look at. I've picked cocaine, hallucinogens, heroin, and methamphetamine. Which years, you can see all the way from 1991 to 2017. And once you've come up with that information, it automatically creates the chart for you. And one nice thing about the chart as well is you'll notice that the colors of the lines in the chart match the colors of the data table that we showed you earlier. You see, right? Like the purple there, that represents the hallucinogens, as just like in this table, you saw the hallucinogens were purple, right? So there is a method to it. All of the colors match. So we see the purple for hallucinogens, red for cocaine, blue for methamphetamine, yellow for heroin, and again, lowest recorded rates in history. So if this kind of file interests you, if this kind of data is something you could use, I encourage you to go to the website, mjagenda.com, and when you're there, look for the button that says Become a Patron. Click on that button, select the $9.99 VIP level. You'll be able to get this file and every other file that I make. And folks, coming up soon, I'll have similar files from Monitoring the Future on the perception of drugs' harmfulness, the disapproval of drugs by these kids, every other table that I can find from Monitoring the Future, as well as the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. That's the one that the federal government conducts that asks all people of all ages their use of drugs, their mental health status, and so forth. And we'll include other data sets like the fatality analysis reporting system from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. In other words, folks, subscribe as a VIP patron, and all the data I look up is yours.
I support a change in law to end federal criminal penalties for possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Ah, yes, President Jimmy Carter calling for decriminalization at the federal level all the way back in 1977. That clip is from. That amazing? 41 years later, and we're still trying to decriminalize federally. By the way, Jimmy Carter was on Colbert's show last week. 93 years old and still constitutionally eligible to run for president. Run, Jimmy, run! Jimmy Carter, 2020. If you work in the cannabis industry, consume marijuana, or just support freedom, you need to know about breaking policy news that affects you. Marijuana Moment is the daily newsletter that helps you stay on top of all the latest and most important state, federal, and international cannabis developments. Brought to you by longtime legalization activist Tom Angel, Marijuana Moment puts a concise yet comprehensive overview of cannabis news in your inbox early every weekday morning. Wake up to Marijuana Moment and rest assured you'll be ready for the cannabis news that's driving the day. Subscribe now at marijuanamoment.net.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Where'd you learn that, Cheech? Drug school.
Learn more at mjagenda.com. The Marijuana Agenda is a listener-supported independent podcast brought to you by Radical Russ Media, LLC. Subscribe to our VIP feed at mjagenda.com for access to our ad-free podcast segment archive. Make a one-time donation to support the Marijuana Agenda at paypal.me/radicalruss. Now, in the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Marijuana Agenda presents this anti-drug public service announcement.
When I was 15, 16, I took drugs, and I spent a lot of time hanging out with people who usually I wouldn't even want to deal with. I got really tired of that feeling of letting things happen to me instead of making things happen. But, you know, you can't make things happen if you're on drugs. It's just not possible. So look, have a little faith in yourself. Life can be pretty fun if you're straight.
This has been an actual anti-drug public service announcement. To combat this and other drug war hysteria, listen to the Marijuana Agenda every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific at live.mjagenda.com or download the free podcast at mjagenda.com.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
You're not high. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
It's not recreational. It can be destructive, and it consistently is destructive.
Okay, maybe you're a little high.
Hey everybody, it's Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
This is Police for Reform, brought to you by Law Enforcement Action Partnership at LEAP.cc. LEAP is a group of law enforcement professionals advocating for criminal justice reforms in the areas of drug prohibition, mass incarceration, asset forfeiture, community policing, and more. LEAP provides qualified speakers across the world to speak with authority on criminal justice issues. We visit with one such speaker now in Police for Reform.
Welcome to another edition of Police for Reform, the podcast for Law Enforcement Action Partnership. I'm Russ Belville, and joining us today, we have the executive director of LEAP. It's Major Neil Franklin joining us. Welcome back, Neil.
Russ, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
I couldn't have thought of a more perfect person to get on the show to address the most recent scandal that's taking place out of Baltimore, where the police department was caught not once but twice on body cams in what appears to be incidences of, at best, recreating evidence collecting of drugs, and at worst, planting evidence of drugs. And you worked in the Baltimore Police Department for a long time in education and training. So what is going on in Baltimore, Neil? What can we tell our listeners about this scandal?
Well, first, let me say that nowhere in our training or in our policies, and you're right, I was the head of training from 2000 to 2004 in the Baltimore Police Department. Not only in our training specific to the Baltimore Police Department, but in the Maryland Police Correctional Training Commission, which is the regulatory body for all training of police officers in the state of Maryland, there's nothing in their 700-plus objectives that has anything to do that instructs anyone on recreating the collection of evidence. It just doesn't exist, and it doesn't make sense. Which therefore leaves this these two episodes very, very questionable. I think that they speak for themselves. This isn't the movies. You don't recreate evidence collection because the importance of that, and these police officers know what the importance of evidence collection is, that it has to be articulated accurately. You have to speak to it truthfully, and you can't recreate something point for point for point for point. You're always going to miss something, omit something, or add something that could be extremely problematic when it comes to testifying in court. So it makes no sense. We don't teach it. We wouldn't dare teach it or instruct it or build any type of program around recreating the collection of any evidence.
And what's concerning about this is after we saw what happened in Ferguson, we saw numerous cell phone cam incidences of police behaving badly, let's say. There was a lot of call for, hey, we need to have these body cams. We got to have body cams on the police so we can make sure that the interactions are being accurately recorded. But We, in these situations, we got cops that are turning the cams off, turning them on, using them to fabricate evidence. What can we do with body cams, or body cams not the solution? What do we do about this?
Well, it goes to show that there's, along with the good that comes from body cams, comes the bad. And, you know, despite these two occurrences, and I'm sure that there are probably more throughout the country, you know, the benefit of having body cams, so let's get that out right now. The benefit of having body cams greatly outweighs this type of activity by our police officers. You know, so what do we have to do? We go back to the drawing board. We look at policy. You know, we look at oversight. We look at accountability. And we start recreating policy. We start rewriting policy to fix these holes that we're seeing. As technology improves, I think we'll be able to solve some of that. As battery life improves, I think we'll be able to have these things running 24/7 in the background. And along with that, policy will change to deal with that. But we always have to be searching for solutions to problems like this. So I hope that no one's thinking that, well, let's get rid of the body cams because here we have problems. No, as I said before, the benefits greatly outweigh situations such as this. I mean, number one, we know that when people are wearing body cams, we know that when people are using their cell phones to record, you know what? People on both sides behave better. The cops behave better and the citizens behave better. And then when things don't go as best as they possibly can, for the most part, we're collecting good evidence that can be used, that can be very useful in determining someone's guilt or innocence, and also in determining whether or not a police officer is using excessive force, whether they're being brutal, and in some cases that unfortunately result in the deaths of our citizens.
So with respect to these body cams having an off button, is this a technological limitation? You mentioned something about battery life and such, or are there political considerations, say police unions that don't want every minute of the day filmed or something?
Well, it's all the above. There is a technical aspect to it, limited battery life, but also from the political perspective, and also dealing with the privacy issues as well. I mean, many times police officers have to go into the homes of people, and the calls vary. And, you know, you need to be able to deactivate the recording. If you're in the home of a citizen, it could be a sexual assault case. It can be something involving some sensitive family matters and so on. So there should be some type of process for that. But all you need is accountability. All you need is the proper policy and accountability to deal with those situations. And then for the most part, they will record most of the time that they're being warned. The other political part regarding the union, yes, I mean, if I'm a cop, I got to relieve myself. There are things that I need to do that I really don't want recorded that are personal in nature also. I'm sure you don't want, I know I don't want to see it. I'm sure your listeners don't either.
Now, you mentioned accountability as well, and one of the things that gets frustrating for observers of these issues of police malfeasance, speaking of the Baltimore cops, they're on paid administrative leave, and the Washington Post recently came out with an investigative report showing how cops are fired and rehired many times by the same department because the police union appeals the firing, and there's some technicality that got missed. I mean, I think some people are worried that, you know, there's no way of tracking bad cops. There's if a bad cop's rooted out of one department, he goes and moves to some other county or some other state and gets another job. What do you think about that issue of accountability and holding these bad cops to account?
Yeah, so there are a couple key points here. Number one, in many of our states, not most, there's things such as the Police Officer's Bill of Rights. These are rights that have been afforded to law enforcement officers throughout the years because of improprieties at the managerial level. You know, if you don't like a particular person as a sergeant or a lieutenant or a commander, you know what? You put things in place. You get the wheels moving to get rid of them. A lot of that was also along the lines of race, where African-American police officers were being booted out of police departments with no protection. So here we now have Police Officers' Bill of Rights. And we also have union contracts in many of our police departments that even go well beyond the Police Officer's Bill of Rights and the protections afforded there. And so when you have these very strong negotiated contracts, it's not only very difficult to get rid of the police officers, but there are also many windows, you know, for bringing them back if you don't cross your T's and dot your I's in the investigations and so on. You know, the other part of this on a national level that you mentioned, when police officers are terminated and they pop up somewhere else, either within state or out of state, there is a solution. There is a solution, Rush, for this. And, you know, right now, the police officers are insured by the cities and towns and states that they work for. Blanket policies cover their behavior, their negligence, and when the civil suits are filed, it's usually the department and the jurisdiction that has to foot the bill, the taxpayers. How about we have insurance? Each police officer carries their own malpractice insurance, just like doctors do, similar to that. So now the police departments can pay the basic premiums, but any rise in premiums because of, you know, like you have an accident with your car, what happens to your policy? Your premium goes up, right? So rises will be borne by the police officer. And you know what? If you have too many lawsuits, or maybe one is even enough if it's severe enough, then that insurance company drops you. Now, if you can't get insurance as a police officer anywhere in the country because of your record, because of your brutality and your excessive force complaints, then you know what? You can't be a police officer because you can't get insured. This is the kind of thinking that we need. I'm not saying that this would work, but have we ever looked at it? I don't think so. I haven't seen anyone try it. We just need to start thinking out of the box. We need to have databases that track police officers who have been terminated from police departments so that when you do fill out an application for another police department across the country, pops up. There's a red flag. Well, let's do an investigation. We see that you have problems in this department. You were terminated from that, so we got to dig. It's all it takes. It doesn't take a lot, but we just haven't gotten to that point yet. We have, you know, the Fraternal Order of Police, and we have other police unions across the country to make it difficult for us to move in this type of direction. Just common sense.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this is something I'm really happy to hear about and glad that Law Enforcement Action Partnership is bringing this to the fore. Let's give some information to our listeners out there if they want to get involved with this reforming of our police and leading this popular charge by the people to try to come up with some sort of accountability. Can you give them some resources they could use?
Absolutely. Well, the first one they can go to is our website. It's lawenforcementaction.org. Go to lawenforcementaction.org, and you'll see the different silos that we have there. And a lot of what we're talking about here on this show, Russ, is dealing with our first silo, police-community relations. Obviously, when we have problems like this, it is a great detriment to building positive relationships between police and community, which then lead to other things and other problems in society. So we have to solve for these things so that we can improve those relationships between police and community, deal with some of the disparity issues that we have across the country. And at the end of the day, the goal is, and let me just make something perfectly clear. LEAP, the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, we are pro-police. We are pro-citizens. We are pro the profession. We want things to be professional. We want strong relationships between police and community. We want the community and the police to be one, not something that you have to build a bridge between. They should be one. And that's the reason we do this work, among others, but that's one of the main reasons we do this work. We want the police to be held accountable. We believe we are cops. Russ, we are cops, yeah. We are judges, we are prosecutors, and we want our profession to be just that, extremely professional and one with the community. And you know what? We have to identify not just the systemic problems that we're dealing with, such as the war on drugs, all right? But we also have to identify and remove those problem police officers, problem commanders. And you know what? From time to time, you might have to redo a whole police department if it's that corrupt.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Major Neil Franklin is the executive director of Law Enforcement Action Partnership. Check him out at lawenforcementaction.com and get more information today. Neil, thanks for joining us again. And I hope the news that we get out of Baltimore next time is much brighter.
Thanks a lot, Russ. And thanks for having me on board. Things will improve in Baltimore. Just keep an eye on us.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
Health Cannabinoid, your ACMPR experts. Consultation services for medical cannabis. Visit healthcannabinoid.com or call 1-800-906-1383. That's www.healthcannabinoid.com or call 1-800-906-1383. Health Cannabinoid.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
What are you people? On dope?
Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
This November, whether you see the words medical marijuana on your ballot or not, the issue is there. From the halls of Congress to your state capitol or city hall, politicians are already making decisions on medical marijuana policy on your behalf. This election, make sure they are representing you. Every vote is a vote for medical marijuana.
Visit votemedicalmarijuana.org today. The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville is brought to you by Cannabis Kamikaze, a professional licensed producer from Canada producing 3 pounds per light. Follow Cannabis Kamikaze on Twitter at Cannabis Kamikaze. That's at Cannabis, K-A-M-I-K-A-Z. Cannabis Kamikaze.
total war against public enemy public number one.
Ten federal criminal penalties for one ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am healed. That was
the point. I think it would be a mistake to leave.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
Don't smoke marijuana. Well, as we mentioned at the top of the show, today is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis, Tennessee. And in just about 20 minutes from now, the bells will toll in Memphis to mark the time, the exact time, 6:01 Central Time, p.m., that he was killed. And as we think about this anniversary, I think it's important to bring up the fact that Dr. King wasn't killed simply because he fought for racial justice. It had a lot to do with it. Absolutely. The civil rights era was turbulent throughout the late 50s and throughout the 1960s. Absolutely. That had a lot to do with it. But it was not the only reason. In studying Dr. King, I find that he's fought against three evils he saw in society, not just racism, but also materialism and militarism. And it's those latter two, materialism in the form of capitalism and militarism in the form of colonization and endless wars, that I believe had a greater impact on leading to his assassination. I believe that as he started to challenge the power structure itself and the entire foundation of American capitalism is when he became too dangerous for the FBI, too dangerous for the CIA, too dangerous for the powers that be. And as I was looking around the internet today, many people remembering Dr. King, I found a particularly good writer out there. She writes at I Write All Day _ and goes by the handle of Clarkeisha Kent. And she brought forth some quotes from Dr. King that a lot of folks just kind of gloss on over. I shouldn't say everybody, but many people, especially white folks, want to make Dr. King some sort of lovable, huggable, gentle giant of a man when he was a radical revolutionary. And at in his time was quite controversial and not a beloved, well-respected figure like he is today among all people. So here's some of these quotes from Dr. King that I hope give you some idea of what he was really fighting against. Dr. King said, quote, "Capitalism did not prosper out of the Protestant ethic of hard work and sacrifice. The fact is that capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of black slaves, and continues to thrive on the exploitation of the poor, both black and white, both here and abroad." Quote, "The problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power." Quote, "It is cruel. It is a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps." Quote, "If peace means keeping my mouth shut in the midst of injustice and evil, I don't want it. If peace means a willingness to be exploited economically, dominated politically, humiliated and segregated, I don't want peace." Quote, "The Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who paternalistically says, 'I agree with you and the goal you seek, but I can't agree with your methods of direct action.'" Quote, "I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without first having spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government." Quote, "There aren't enough white persons in our country who are willing to cherish democratic principles over privilege." Quote, "However difficult it is to hear, however shocking it is to hear, we've got to face the fact that America is a racist country." End quote. And that's just the surface, just scratching the surface of what Dr. King had to say about capitalism, materialism, violence, an oppression in this society. And I would argue in this rant that the war on drugs, as it was constituted in the early 20th century, rose as a direct response to the dismantling of slavery and the dismantling, the beginning of the unraveling of Jim Crow. And that it continued and was fostered throughout these days as a tool to maintain a racial segregation, to maintain a permanent underclass, to ensure that there was an easy way to violate the civil rights of people in certain neighborhoods, people of a certain class. I smell marijuana. Just unlocks the Fourth Amendment just like that. Hell, we even seen Representative Joe Kennedy III, the scion of the Kennedy clan, the rising star in the Democratic Party who delivered the State of the Union response to President Trump. Joe Kennedy III was caught in a gaffe, you know, accidentally speaking the truth, when he said he lamented the decriminalization of marijuana in Massachusetts because it took away from prosecutors the easy tool they had to go after the bad guys. Cops could no longer claim they smelled marijuana and use that as a pretext for a stop, use that as a pretext for a search. Yeah, Joe Kennedy III, some Democrat. Right up there with Andrew Cuomo in New York. And this drug war, the evidence for it being a tool of racism, intended tool of racism, never intended to try to keep people safe, never intended to save the children from some sort of terrible outcome. No, intended from its beginning. To be used as a tool to lock up certain people. We need only go back to Harry J. Anslinger. You knew he was coming. Harry J. Anslinger, the director of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which was the progenitor to the DEA, right? Back in the day, it was the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. He held this post from 1930 to 1962. This guy goes from Herbert Hoover all the way to JFK. 32 years, this man set the tone from the top down for what our drug war policies would be. And here are some of his quotes. Here's some of the things this man thought and was fine with speaking openly. Quote, "Reefer makes darkies think they're as good as white men." Quote, "There are 100,000 total marijuana smokers in the U.S., and most are Negroes, Hispanics, Filipinos, and entertainers. Their satanic music, jazz, and swing result from marijuana usage. This marijuana causes white women to seek sexual relations with Negroes, entertainers, and any others." Yeah, it's the marijuana, sure. And you got to note, too, 100,000 total marijuana smokers back in the 1930s. What are we at, 31 million today? What a great job the drug war has done. Quote, "The primary reason to outlaw marijuana is its effect on the degenerate races." This is a man who was in control of our drug policy for an entire generation. And the stark racism of Harry J. Anslinger is borne out in the statistics that we still see today. Black people, 3.7 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana than whites, more likely to be convicted, more likely to get a stiffer sentence. Yet the rates of marijuana use, the rates of marijuana sales, the rates of marijuana cultivation are pretty much even between the races. The drug war continued throughout the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, but didn't really gear up until the late 60s as marijuana became popular among young people, became a symbol of rebellion, became associated with protests of the Vietnam War and the draft, protests for black civil rights, for women's rights. It became synonymous with leftist ideology. And that leads us to where the drug war went from being just the feelings, the racial animosity built up under Harry J. Anslinger and his acolytes, to being codified and being structured into the war on drugs we know today. And of course, the man behind that would be none other than Richard Milhouse Nixon. Richard Nixon, 37th president of the United States, who infamously taped his White House. We have these Nixon White House tapes where it's revealed he's a racist, right? Cut from the same cloth as Harry Anslinger. There was one of his advisors, H.R. Haldeman, was his chief of staff. And Haldeman kept diaries of some of the things that Nixon said. And there's one segment of the diary. This is reported in the New York Times in 1994. One segment of the diary that reads, quote, Nixon emphasized, he actually referred to him as P for president, but Nixon emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. Pointed out that there has never in history been an adequate black nation. And they are the only race of which this is true. Says Africa is hopeless. The worst there is Liberia, which we built. End quote. The key is the blacks. We have to find a way to deal with the blacks, a system that will deal with the blacks without appearing to, without openly talking about the blacks. As Lee Atwater once famously said that in the 1950s, you could use the N-word. By the 60s, that became kind of taboo. You had to find a way to blow that dog whistle, to get the racists to understand you were on their side without coming right out and saying it. And that war on drugs, that war on marijuana, was a key to it. The evidence of this, of course, revealed in a 2016, Harper's Magazine, that was written by Dan Baum, an author, and who had interviewed John Ehrlichman, another one of the co-conspirators with Haldeman, John Dean, and the others with Watergate. And Ehrlichman was in 1994 interviewed by Dan Baum, and wanted to talk to him about drug prohibition, about the drug war, what's it all about. And this is what Ehrlichman had to say. Quote, "You want to know what this was really all about? The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and the blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did." End quote. A drug war that was birthed in racism of Harry J. Anslinger and codified into law under the Controlled Substances Act, the establishment of the DEA, under the racist Richard Nixon, who saw hippies and black people as his enemies and the criminalization of drugs as a way to disrupt them. As it has always been. Drugs have always been prohibited, and all the prohibition of them has always been used as a tool of oppressing people of color, minorities, immigrants. The first anti-drug laws we had in this country were drug laws against Chinese opium dens. Not opium. By God, no. At the turn of the century, laudanum, opium, a type of opiate, was one of the most popular medications of the times. The women were using laudanum, men were using laudanum. It was only when the women started using them in the Chinese opium dens that it became problematic. Same thing with the marijuana. People had been using cannabis for a couple of centuries in America. It was only when the Mexican migrants, after the Mexican War of Independence, started coming into America, started coming into El Paso and the border cities, started coming in there, take it or drugs. So they criminalized them for the weed that they smoked. We see that in the laws against cocaine. And we had, you know, Sigmund Freud, for example, is a well-known cocaine user. People were using cocaine. Nobody thought of a problem with it until the black people started using it in the South. And then it became the drug that makes them superhuman strong and they can stop bullets and etc. And that continued and has continued up through the 70s, where we're going to criminalize the blacks and the hippies with their heroin and their marijuana. It continued through the 80s, where we had the crack baby scare, the demonization of people in the inner city. Continued through the 90s, Bill Clinton, get tough on crime, the crime bill, having to go after the super predators. So as we look back at the legacy of Dr. King, and we look back on this 50th anniversary, let's make sure that we understand that fighting against the drug war is part and parcel of fighting for racial reconciliation in this country. We cannot possibly solve any of our problems of race while a drug war still rages. There's just no way. It is structurally built to be racist, built by racists, built for racist purposes. And we cannot move on from it. We've got to stop it. And I know that legalization of marijuana is a good start, but even in the legalization of marijuana, we see how structurally racist it is. How in ending its prohibition, black people are still being left out. how now when we got legal weed shops, 999 out of 1,000 of them are owned by white people. Black folks did the time and white folks make the dimes. It's not the way it should be. Every step forward is beset by problems that we still have to deal with. And I believe that that problem, the problem of disproportionate representation in cannabis business among minorities, is not solvable until we deal with the racial problems in our entire economic structure to begin with. And that can't happen while the drug war is going on. It's kind of a cycle here. We've got to end this drug war, to take from the police, to dismantle from our policing this tool of being able to bypass people's civil rights, bypass people's civil liberties. The other thing the drug war has done has led to this arms race escalation between gangs and cops. That's why we've got so many trigger happy cops out there. They never know when they're going to be facing someone with massive firepower. And the gangs, they had to build up massive firepower because their product's illegal. They can't deal with their competitors in court. They can't sue the other gang. They've got to fight it out in the streets with their guns. Legalization begins to unravel that part of the problem as well. The end of the war on drugs, and I mean all drugs, not just marijuana, is something that I believe Dr. King, were he alive today at the age of 89, would be strongly supporting. Would be strongly supporting the end. Would be supporting clean needle exchanges, safe injection facilities, dance safe, expansion of MDMA and hallucinogens in therapy. And most importantly, the end of the criminalization of people, not just black people, all people, the end of criminalization of people for what they choose to do with themselves. It's at the core of what it means to be American, to be free, to determine how your life is going to be lived, what direction you intend to go, and not necessarily for good. It's also your right as an American to fuck up your life beyond all repair. Hell, we let people do it with alcohol perfectly legally. They ought to be able to do it with marijuana, or any other drug for that matter. That's all the time we got for hour one. For our patrons out at MJAgenda.com, hour two is coming up next on the podcast. Get your secret feed at MJAgenda.com.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
For everyone here at Delta 9 House and Studios, I'm Radical Russ Melville. Thanks for joining us. Check me out at RadicalRuss.com. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers. You're growing it, you're trying to roll it, you're smoking it, it goes.